Hello and welcome to the Foxhole Companion with me, Dan Stewart.
And me, Simon Rance.
The podcast that brings you the chronological history of the Second World War as seen through the silver screen. And today we have a legendary, epic naval battle.
We do indeed. We have Lewis Gilbert's Sink the Bismarck, starring, obviously, Kenneth Moore.
Whee!
And Dana Winter, or Dana Winter, or Donna Winter, depends what you want to call her, really.
Yeah, well, she came from quite a few places and changed her name a few times. So, Simon's going to give you a little bit of background on the film.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's based on that very sea-salty dog of a writer, C.S. Forrester's book, The Last 9 Days of the Bismarck, also known as Hunting the Bismarck. Obviously, he's best known for his Horatio Hornblower books. So that was published in 59, and the film was made in 1960, released in 1960 in February.
Was it just me, or did it seem older than 1960?
Well, we've said that about a couple of things recently, haven't we? And I really think it's to do with where it's made, because it's certainly not budget. For instance, when we were 49th Parallel in parts felt like quite a modern film.
Mm.
And then
almost Hitchcockian.
Yeah, but then you'd have Trevor Howard, and all of a sudden it felt 30 years older.
Mm.
You know, he had that sort of BBC voice. But this feels very old in parts, and like that, very modern in parts, I think. Now, the leads are incredible. Kenneth Moore's probably, I mean, it's probably one of his best performances. And unlike other...
What, you mean better than Reach for the Sky?
Well, obviously much better than Reach for the Sky. And to be fair, Kenneth Moore's performance in Reach for the Sky was the best thing about it.
Well.
Although he was playing a dastardly human being. In this, he's not. He's playing Captain Shepherd, who is, comes across a little bit like his Reach for the Sky character, but he's on the high seas in the beginning. And it's his character takes turns of redemption, and you find out why he is so strict and so on and so forth. He's lost his wife and his son is at war, and he will be responsible in the Navy, and he could quite possibly be responsible for his son and his son's crew's demise or victory. So he's a man very, very much under pressure, and he performs that with amazing gravitas. His co-star, as I said before, is, I'm going to call her Dana Winter, okay?
Yeah.
You can call her Donna Winter, which I believe...
What about Dana Winter?
Dana Winter, Dana Winter, up your Winter.
Whee!
So she is... also has a wonderful performance, and she also has lost someone. She's lost someone very dear to her in Dunkirk. And these two
was he a fiancé or
yes,
husband?
I think it's a fiancé.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of hard to tell. We watched it only a few days ago. And it's one of those, much like Reach for the Sky, much like The Cruel Sea, we sat down and we were like, we've definitely seen this before. And I don't think I have. I think Dan has seen it.
I feel like I've seen this.
Mm. But it obviously didn't make too much of a lasting impression on you. Now, obviously, the story of the sinking of the Bismarck, Dan will take you through that, is probably one of the most important British naval battles ever, sinking this almighty destroyer, the Bismarck, which is seen as unsinkable. Before we go on to that, I just want to talk about a couple more things about the film.
Yeah, go on.
So it had a budget. Again, I still can't quite get my head around the size of these budgets back all the way back then. A budget, this is dollars though, a budget of $1,330,000 in 1960, but it made $3 million.
Okay, so it did very well for itself.
It did extremely well, both here and abroad, US and Canada. Yes, it was a big, big hit. As I said, the film is directed by Lewis Gilbert, and we know that name.
Hey!
Because he made Reach for the Sky.
Oh, boom!
he was also two of my favourite Bond movies. He made You Only Live Twice, which is the great one that we talked about the last time we did a Lewis Gilbert film. with the Donald Pleasance as Blofeld in his volcanic lair.
And his cat.
And of course, the much underrated Moonraker, which is so good, it should be called Boomraker.
What about The Spy Who Loved Me, Simon?
That's appalling.
Well, he directed that as well.
I know he did.
But anyway, he also later directed Educating Rita in 1983 and Shirley Valentine, which are sort of British classics.
So Günther Lütjens, who is the admiral who's aboard the Bismarck, he is played by Karol Stepanek. Now, a lot of this film was praised for its realism. But the only criticism that comes across seems to be about the portrayal of Günther Lütjens. Now, he is portrayed in this film as one of our stereotypical Nazis, very much so. It's like, this ship is unsinkable! And all
yeah.
this.
Yeah.
And he wasn't like that at all. In fact, he comes across much more like the character that Peter Finch plays in Battle of the River Plate. He didn't believe the Bismarck was unsinkable. He was one of the only people who wouldn't give a Hitler salute when Hitler visited the Bismarck.
Controversial.
Yeah, instead just giving the normal naval salute. And like he also, along with other naval commanders, spoke out against anti-Semitic crimes, especially during Kristallnacht. But in the film, he is quoted as saying, "Never forget that you are Nazis." But also, the term Nazi wouldn't have been used too much in Germany at that point.
Because it was a sort of,
it's a negative, you know.
It was a pejorative term used by communists in Germany in the mid-30s.
Yeah.
As they're sort of getting their own back for the sort of pejorative terms that the right wing called them.
Exactly.
And they came up with Nazi, which was a sort of bastardized acronym for
National Socialism.
National Socialist Party, Democratic Party, I believe is what it was. I'm not going to pretend to try and say the German full title.
No, fair enough.
As much as you all want me to, I'm not going to.
Lütjens was not the man that he is portrayed to be in this film. And as I said, he was very pessimistic of the success of Bismarck on its mission. He thought it would be... The task was too huge. And also one of the criticisms of the film is in the film, Lütjens orders the captain, Ernst Lindemann, to open fire on HMS Hood and the Prince of Wales. He did not do that. He told Lindemann to avoid becoming engaged.
Yeah, he didn't want to engage, did he?
But Lindemann, who is portrayed as like the sort of much more pacifist of the two in this film, refused and ordered to open fire.
Interesting, because they swapped that around so that the admiral is much more the...
Well, he's a fascist, fascist.
Total fascist, whereas the captain, played by Karl Mohner, Captain Ernst Lindemann, seemed to be much more the sort of, but I want to save my men.
Yeah.
Anti-fascist, almost.
And it really wasn't the case. Everything else, though, seems to be pretty much spot on. Tell us a bit about the Bismarck itself and why it's such an important part of World War II.
Well, it's interesting because, yes, it was very important whilst being sort of deeply anticlimactic, certainly for the Germans. The Germans built two Bismarck-class battleships, one being the Bismarck, the other being her sister ship, the Tirpitz.
The what? Turnips?
The Tirpitz. They were the two largest battleships ever built by Germany and two of the largest built by any European power at that time.
Okay.
They were enormous. And there's a very interesting thing that happened. I was just listening to a podcast recently, and I can't remember the name of which one it was because I listened to quite a few, that was talking about the shift in weaponry that people think is the crucial part of their military, and how certainly as far as the Navy's concerned, World War One and post-World War One, there seemed to be this view that the bigger floating battery you had on the sea, the more powerful you were going to be.
Right.
And what actually turned out was that these huge, almost dinosaurs, if you like, were outmaneuvered by what would become, post-World War II, the actual crucial part of any navy, which is an aircraft carrier. And the Bismarck and the Tirpitz, that did even less than the Bismarck. At least the Bismarck had about 9 days of actual trying to have a fight, whereas the Tirpitz, being left by itself now as this sort of remaining flagship of the German Navy, never really left the fjords. And that's where it was sunk by a whole fleet of Lancaster bombers who basically bombed it to the bottom of a fjord. And again, you see, these were huge, unwieldy monsters that were taken down by agile, tiny, little aircraft.
Right, okay.
And in the case of the Bismarck, tiny being the operative term, because the only planes that the British had on their aircraft carriers, Ark Royal and HMS Victorious.
Which Kenneth Moore served on during the war.
Wow.
Yeah. So before the war, Kenneth Moore was working as an actor for the Wolverhampton Rep. Haven't you done something in Wolverhampton?
I have played Wolverhampton, darling, yes.
But is it still called the Wolverhampton Rep?
No, it's called the Wolverhampton Grand now.
Okay.
And it's very grand as well.
Anyway, so he was living at 166 Waterloo Road. Do you know Waterloo Road in Wolverhampton?
No,
anyway, he was also an ambulance driver.
Wow.
But anyway, yeah, then he was commissioned as a lieutenant in the Royal Navy and saw service aboard...
HMS Victorious.
Yeah, well, but firstly above the cruiser HMS Aurora and the aircraft carrier HMS Victorious.
Wow. So there is this really very, very interesting shift that happens here in 1941, where Germany launches these monstrous ships that outgun anything the Allies have by a long, long way, who are ultimately destroyed by these little tiny planes carrying torpedoes that are launched from aircraft carriers. And over the next 70, 80 years, you're going to see the aircraft carrier become the most important armament in any navy. Mm-hmm. And the ability of what we call the Western powers today to launch devastating strikes from aircraft carriers are what makes them as powerful as they are. And aircraft carriers to this day are sort of these enormous floating cities. And there's some talk now that they in turn might be being made obsolete by further advancements on the battlefield.
That was in that wonderful podcast, The Red Line.
Oh, that's what I was talking about. Yeah, you heard it too.
Yeah, The Red
Line. Yeah. So here in 1941, this battleship that had taken 3 years to build was launched with an operation description to interfere with the North Atlantic shipping. And we go back to this thing that we've featured before on a couple of other films, where Britain was basically being kept alive by this constant stream of material and manpower from the United States, who had yet to join the war, but was basically doing what a lot of countries are doing with Ukraine right now, which is keeping it fighting. And for Germany to defeat Great Britain, it was imperative that they basically shut down this channel across the North Atlantic.
The convoys,
yeah.
Which was portrayed so appallingly in the film. Convoy!
How dare you? One of the greatest films ever made.
Oh, it's not. Go on.
So the Bismarck was armed with 8 15-inch guns. I mean, that is huge. Those are enormous, enormous guns that were arranged in 4 twin gun turrets, 2 super firing turrets forward that were called Anton and Bruno, and 2 aft, which were called Caesar and Dora. They had a secondary armament that consisted of 12 5.9-inch guns, 16 4.1-inch guns, 16 1.5-inch guns, and 12 anti-aircraft guns. This was a floating...
Arsenal,
yeah. I mean, it was just a ginormous deck of guns. It was huge. And basically, the Allies had nothing that could compete with it.
Okay, so how did they do it?
The Germans launched Bismarck and a smaller ship, not by much though, the Prince Eugen, through the Denmark Straits. Now, the Allies had been sort of tipped off that this was going to happen. A Norwegian reconnaissance had spotted the flotilla leaving. A very brave Spitfire pilot took what is now a very famous picture at 8,000 feet whilst the Luftwaffe were constantly buzzing around trying to stop this sort of thing from happening. He took this amazing picture of three ships, including the Bismarck, in a fjord. And that sort of got the word out. And Churchill and the leading Navy brass in Whitehall realised the immediate threat that this ship would pose and basically put out an all points alert to the entire British Navy, and including some Polish vessels as well, let's not leave them out, to spread out and sort of form a net in which they would find the Bismarck.
Right.
So much of this battle was a sort of hide and seek between the Bismarck, which very, very quickly became the prey, despite it being so enormous. It was eventually attacked in the Strait of Denmark by two ships, the Prince of Wales and HMS Hood. Now, HMS Hood was the flagship of the British Navy.
Yeah.
And was its most prized possession. I think that the Hood lasted no more than about 10 or 12 minutes in this battle before it was completely blown out of the water. During an exchange of salvos, one of the 38-centimetre armour-piercing shells from the Bismarck struck Hood, penetrated her thin deck armour, and the shell reached Hood's rear ammunition magazine and detonated 112 tonnes of cordite.
Oh dear.
Which basically blew it out of the water. It sank so quickly that out of the 1,419 men that sailed on HMS Hood, three survived.
Oh my God.
The shock waves of the sinking of Hood were felt right the way across the North Atlantic, all the way to Whitehall. And it sort of spurred on the British into being even more determined to find the Bismarck and sink it.
That certainly comes across in the movie.
Oh, for sure.
You know, you have that. I mean, we're used to watching films set in this period with the whole stiff upper lip and all that. But what this film does do very well is show how dogged the British military were. I'm not going to say were and are, but definitely were.
Because they're still learning,
you know. Because they're still learning, because they hadn't come up across anything like this before. Coming up against, it's just like, you know, it's the Titanic with missiles. I mean, it's just this beast.
Well, the analogy I like that I've come up with, if I do say so myself, is it's more like the Death Star.
Yeah.
So in terms of threat to the world, these two ships were like twin Death Stars. Unsinkable, unreachable, because their range of guns was so much further than anything the Allies had. So you had to do this sort of Battle of the River Plate tactic of just steaming directly at it and hoping you weren't sunk before you got within range.
As I was going to say, just like the Graf Spree, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, the point is that there's no point going at it in orthodox battle because there's no chance. So, you know, the way that how they did it in almost like guerrilla-like warfare on the sea was the only way to take it down, much like the rebels do take down the Death Star.
Well, this is it. So there is a happy ending, basically. Fortunately, before the Prince of Wales had to run away, having watched the HMS Hood explode out of the water in front of them, is they had managed to get a shot off that did pierce the hull of the Bismarck to the point where it was really slowed down. And this is really important because not only could the Bismarck outgun anything that it was facing, it could also outrace anything it was facing. It had a much larger range. the British ships were already finding themselves in this sort of cat and mouse game of hide and seek, that they were running low on fuel. So as they became more and more desperate to find the Bismarck in turn, having been hurt just enough to make it impossible for them to stay out at sea, started this sprint for the French coast, where they could come within range of their U-boats and other naval ships that could help them, and a port where they could refit. And this is basically the whole excitement of this battle, was the British trying to track it and chase it whilst the Bismarck fled for France. And the big turnaround came when HMS Victorious, the aircraft carrier, launched 6 Fairey Fulmar fighters and 9 Fairey Swordfish torpedo bombers. Now, this all sounds very exciting and modern, but as the film very accurately points out, these were biplanes made out of balsa wood and canvas.
Open-topped
in the North Atlantic with a giant torpedo strapped underneath them.
Crazy.
Now, this is the bit where the British ended up being incredibly lucky, because both times the aircraft carriers launched aircraft to attack the Bismarck, they initially attacked the wrong ships. More importantly, they attacked their own ships.
Yeah.
So this first foray of planes mistook, somehow, a US Coast Guard cutter as the Bismarck. I can only imagine that these guys flying in open-top biplanes just had no idea what they were looking for, what they were doing, and fortunately called off.
Just looking for large lumps of metal in the sea. I mean, you know, it's not.
Yeah, oh, there's a ship sinking.
Well, can you imagine how poor the vision would be as well?
Yeah. Well, as British ships basically spread out across the North Atlantic, and it was a huge area of water, in a desperate attempt to find it, it came down to the HMS Ark Royal and its planes to A, try and find the Bismarck and then attack it. Consequently, the Ark Royal Swordfish were launched after the Bismarck had been spotted. And again, amazingly, mistook HMS Sheffield for the Bismarck and actually torpedoed it. But fortunately for the British, the torpedoes, which were loaded with magnetic detonators, they didn't work. So a bunch of torpedoes, and this is in the film too, hit the Sheffield but didn't explode. And what happened is then the planes realised their mistake, went back to the Ark Royal, and then fitted themselves with contact detonators on their torpedoes, which were, in the end, going to make all the difference. A really sort of shocking and tragic side note to this is that, of course, it was HMS Sheffield, not the same ship, of course, but its namesake in the Falkland War, that was hit by a Argentinian missile and exploded it at the loss of a lot of lives.
Yep.
But this particular HMS Sheffield survived. So these Swordfish biplanes found the Bismarck and launched their torpedoes, and a lot of them missed. I can't even imagine how hard that is when you're faced with that kind of armament. But one torpedo in particular hit the Bismarck in her stern on the port side near the port rudder shaft. And this is the most important part, and it jammed the rudder in a position which basically sent the Bismarck on a giant circle, which it could not escape from. And this was weirdly...
That's done quite well in the movie too.
It is, yeah, absolutely. And they do sort of, they do explore that from the German point of view, that they're now stuck going around in giant circles, and with the British fleet closing in. By the time the British fleet did close in, the Bismarck was facing 13 Allied ships, an aircraft carrier, 2 battleships, 3 cruisers, and 7 destroyers.
Wow.
Which just shows how desperate the British were to put this ship at the bottom of the ocean, which they did.
And two of the ships involved, of course, were the Suffolk and the Norfolk.
Oh, here we go.
And I just want to say, actually, when it's mentioned in the film, so many times they'd be like, rah, 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 rah. HMS Norfolk, HMS Suffolk. They keep saying the Suffolk and the Norfolk until finally they get it the right way round. Someone says the Norfolk and the Suffolk. Thank you very much.
I can't tell you how many times during this film Simon tutted in exasperation because the Suffolk was named before the Norfolk.
I mean, it makes no sense. I mean, it's not even in alphabetical order.
So. Personally, my favourite that was... probably the ship that fired the salvo that actually sank the Bismarck was HMS Rodney.
No income tax, no guarantee.
Well, anyone outside of Britain will not know why that's funny, but no, basically there was a brilliant...
HMS Rodders.
Rodders. There was a British sitcom about a family of dodgy dealers.
From Peckham.
From Peckham, Simon's favourite part of the world.
Not a bad place.
Living on a council estate that sold hooky gear, stolen stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the main characters was called Rodney, otherwise known as Rodders. Do you think they referred to it as HMS Rodders?
Probably. Probably the Cockneys who had that great line when it's just like, that'd be like throwing a crumpet at it. And then that other geezer goes like, I wish someone throw some crumpet at me.
Fortunately for everybody. And we're going to turn it over to the film now.
My old man actually still says crumpet. I mean, he is 84 and he is from East London, but he's still...
What, when referring to a female the fairer sex,
yeah. He will say like, oh, lovely bit of crumpet, son. It's really embarrassing, but still quite funny and endearing.
I can't believe there's anyone left in Britain that still calls women crumpet.
Still says crumpet. Lovely bit of crumpet.
Yeah, so you'll be pleased to know that that this film has its... obligatory Cockneys having a proper moan.
Isn't it? It's so weird.
You've got to have two Cockney geezers being like, oh, I don't know, what are we doing out here? Yeah, I could be at home with the missus, with my feet up in front of the fire.
I know, it's weird, but it's always Cockneys. I find that really strange.
Yeah, no one else in Britain moans, just the Cockneys.
In World War II movies, it's just like, oh, blast this bleeding fog. I mean, seriously.
The Bismarck was eventually sunk on the 27th of May, 9 days after it left its port in the Baltics. Because it was this flagship debut, the Bismarck not only had its contingent of crew, but it had 60 Admiral staff, including Admiral Gunther Lütjens.
Yeah.
It had a whole bunch of press and... this sort of the hangers-on that were there to have a good watch as Bismarck ploughed through the North Atlantic, sinking everything in front of it, ended up filling the ship to over 2,200 men, out of which only 114 survived. And there's one downside of this, which is also brought up in the film, where there's been a criticism against the Allied ships for not having picked up more survivors in the sea. But the reality was that they were in some of the most dangerous waters in the world that were filled with U-boats. And the threat of a U-boat sinking yet more British ships as they stuck around looking for German survivors made it impossible for them to pick up any more than the 114 they did.
That's still pretty mad, though. So like a tenth of the crew essentially survives.
Yeah, not even.
Wow.
A fifth of the crew. So, yeah, huge loss of life on both sides. If you think that only three survived from HMS Hood, and not to mention the ships that were damaged but not sunk and the loss of life on those ships, the Bismarck really did go out fighting. But go out it did. It was ultimately scuttled, actually. The Germans were desperate for the Allies not to get their hands on this ship and the advanced technologies that were on it. So they scuttled the ship. It's not clear whether or not it was Rodders, HMS Rodders that sank it, or it was the scuttling of it. Admiral Lütjens, German survivors claimed that he was seen in the mid-decks by the bridge, or what was left of it, as the ship went down. Others say he was killed earlier on, so it's unsure, but very, very few survived.
But just the massive hubris of doing something like that, of turning warfare and risking all those lives just like, you know, as a PR stunt. And ultimately, it's a humongous disaster, and pretty much everyone on it, including journalists, drown.
Well, and here's the sort of final irony of it all, is that I think the British government and the British Navy were hoping that sinking the Bismarck would be a victory finally to celebrate after 2 years of having literally nothing to celebrate at all.
Yeah.
And ironically, the sinking of the Bismarck was ultimately overshadowed by the loss of Crete, which happened basically on the same day. The loss of Crete and the huge loss of infantry and soldiers and materiel on that island was a huge shock to the Allies and really set the British back again. It was another big disaster, sort of on a Dunkirk level. And one of the reasons they didn't get a lot of those soldiers off the island of Crete was because all those ships were in the North Atlantic chasing the Bismarck.
Right.
So
awful.
A lot of tragedies all sort of unfolding at the same time. So the great PR event of sinking the Bismarck ultimately wasn't very successful because it was overshadowed by this other huge military defeat in Crete. And the Germans had nothing to crow about because they were now so terrified of losing the sister ship Tirpitz that it really never left the fjords until it was found by Lancaster bombers that sank it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. That was basically the end of Germany's, well, naval authority.
Yeah.
Other than the U-boats in the North Atlantic.
Well, that's when everything is relied on the U-boats from then on in, right?
That's it.
That's when all fiscality of naval hardware goes into the U-boats, into the wolf packs.
And there's some historians who do argue that, in fact, Germany was really strapped for resources. It's one of the reasons they desperately wanted Ukraine and Russia, because Germany itself had very little in terms of natural resources, certainly not enough to fuel the sort of military that it needed at this point.
Well, so what, not enough iron ore? Or
yeah, iron ore, steel, oil, all of that. And there are many historians who argue that had the same material that had been pumped into Bismarck and Tirpitz been used to build U-boats instead, which were much more economical in terms of material, that could have really had a massive effect on the British ability to reinforce itself from the United States. So there you go, mistakes all around.
Well, you get that, don't you, in throughout history, never mind throughout military history, but it seems to be very much prominent in the Second World War.
Mm.
There are so many what ifs and buts, if this hadn't happened, if this happy accident hadn't happened. You know,
it's
amazing. It is amazing. So we're in 1941 now. We've talked about probably three or four massive missions which could have gone either way.
Yeah.
We talked about the Battle of River Plate, the Battle of Britain. There's so many times, if they hadn't have rested, if they, you know, if the hubris of the Nazi Party hadn't kicked in on so many occasions and got involved with their military, they may have already been so far in front they would have been unable to be
unstoppable.
Stopped.
Yeah.
But we will never know, thank God. Anyway, so yeah, just quickly back to the film then.
Let's go back to the film.
So let's just talk about, first of all, the atmosphere of the film. So it starts with, we were quite relieved because we've been complaining recently that all British films of this era, but especially war films, all sound like it could be Children's Hour or something.
Romantic comedy.
Yeah, a romantic, yeah, or an Ealing comedy. It's like, you know, it's just like, what the hell is
wasn't
this?
Wasn't this a bit like that?
To start with, we thought we'd got off lightly. We're like, oh, thank God, it's just an air raid siren. We're like, yes, right, that's what we need. And then literally 2 seconds later, we looked at each other in total dismay and it was... I mean, yeah. It's like, oh dear God.
Here we go.
But it's a strange film that sometimes it really captures an atmosphere and then suddenly it can just drop out. Performances are generally strong. I think Kenneth Moore's great. I think Donna Vinter is great.
She is great.
Yeah, Lindemann, the guy who plays Lindemann is
but
great.
But what's her purpose? Why is she there? I mean, it's so weird that they have this love story, don't you think?
Yeah, and also Kenneth Moore even then looked too old for her. It was all a bit strange. I mean, he probably wasn't, but he just looked it. But he does a brilliant turn, I think, as Shepherd, and she is great. But she's like the outside world, and he's the inside of the military. Yeah. You know, so she is like the face of Britain. And sort of reporting back to him what the rest of the country feels like, and he's this kind of like single-minded strategist that, you know, he's much like an engineer, while she is.
But haven't we seen that before?
Oh yeah, totally.
I mean, in Kenneth Moore,
yeah,
playing a naval officer. I mean, if we think about the film with Donald Sinden,
The Cruel Sea,
with Jack Hawkins again, this sort of driven military man with a purpose. I got to be honest, it came as a shock to Simon, but I fell asleep. It was my turn to fall asleep. I mean, to continue my analogy, if you imagine the Bismarck as the Death Star, and if you think about Star Wars: A New Hope, and what the Death Star represented
I refuse to even call it A New Hope. It's just Star Wars.
What the Death Star represented in terms of threat, we talked about this during the film, didn't we?
Yeah.
Is that they could have done so much more to make the Bismarck scary.
Well, that's it. And in some of the movies that we have seen, that is done so well. So we took, I mean, if you think
about...
Well,
they did it with the Graf Spee.
Yeah, no, I mean, but do you remember in, is it April 9th?
Yeah.
When April 9th, oh. when the ship sort of comes out of the fog.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, where's that? You know, where's this huge, daunting, this evil fortress on the sea?
Well, it has part of the problem has again to do with, I'm afraid, the sort of models in a bathtub. And you just, there's not much threat there.
No, this is true.
What they could have done very cleverly is to just cut the Germans out of it,
yeah,
or minimise their actual screen presence so that the Bismarck was more like
a
Jaws.
Myth. More like a myth.
Scary thing in the fog. Yeah, because, by the way, so much of this was in the fog.
Yeah, instead of humanising it.
Yeah, and then having very sort of obvious Nazis, Sieg-Heiling and
which would have made it a top-rate thriller,
but
not the realistic film that is portrayed as becoming.
I think they should make it again.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad idea.
And also, I think we said this before as well about, was it Reach for the Sky? I can't remember which one it was now. But for a film that came out in 1960, if you think about the films that were on the verge of appearing in the next 10 years, boy, does this seem really dated.
No, it does, yeah.
I mean, we're only a few years away from 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, well, Reach for the Sky is very much the same era.
And in terms of war films, you know, when you think of Longest Day.
Yeah.
Which is such an accomplished... I mean, I know we bang on about it all the time, but we do love that film.
Kenneth Moore is also in that.
Kenneth Moore is also in that. God bless him. He's going to win this award, isn't he?
I think he's won it.
Well, this just seems so dated. There's a lot of, right-ho, sir, jolly good, all that sort of nonsense.
I know, it's weird. Reach for the Sky is 56, but even so... you know.
They just seem, I mean, maybe we blame the director. Maybe it's him. He was responsible for him.
Lewis Gilbert.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. It's weird. You're right, though. 2 years later is the longest day.
I know.
Which is
just
nuts.
2 years later. And it's such a sophisticated. I mean, you can watch that film today and be as thrilled and enthralled and excited as I'm sure audiences were in 1962 and 63. Can I give you a little bit of trivia?
Yeah.
Go on. So, you're going to love this.
Probably not.
No, you are.
Oh, my God.
Kenneth Moore was offered the lead in Guns of Navarone in 1961. Talking of which, there's another film that is... I mean, this was 1 year before Guns of Navarone, which is a great film.
Oh, it's wonderful.
He was offered the lead in Guns of Navarone.
What, Gregory Peck's role?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
However...
Oh, what did he take? What year was it? Tell me.
However, he lost the part. He'd been given the part.
Right.
Due to his drunken behaviour at an awards ceremony.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, good old man.
So, this was basically Kenneth Moore's final film, really.
What do you mean?
As a lead.
What?
Yeah, because I think he went to pot. I think he was...
No, he saw he did have a comeback. I mean, if you think about it...
In what?
No, so he had bit parts, but he was... he's back in Dark of the Sun, which is one of the most horrifically violent films I've ever seen.
It's not as bad as Bone Tomahawk.
It's borderline, and it's made in 1968. It's one of the most disturbing films I've ever seen. Dark of the Sun, based on a Wilbur Smith book. He's in that. He's got a brilliant part in that as a doctor.
Yeah, but it's not a lead. That's what I'm saying. This was the last... Critics basically say that in terms of successful films where he played the lead, this was the last one.
Oh, okay. Well,
and I think it was probably because he was staggering around starting fights at award ceremonies.
Okay. Well, I mean, fair play to him. I mean, he went out with a bang. He's also in Oh, What a Lovely War. I mean, seriously, looking at this, he might not win this, actually. I'm just looking at the war films he's been in.
I can't wait to do Oh, What a Lovely War.
So let's just go through...
Is that Michael Horden as well, or is that Ralph Richardson?
I think it's Ralph Richardson.
Okay.
Right, but here we go. Right.
Yep.
Reach for the Sky.
Go on.
That's one. Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, are we going through the Kenneth Moore greatest hits in World War II films?
I was going to say Northwest Frontier, but that's actually about the frontier. That's about the Northwest Passage. That's Scott of the Antarctic, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, Sink the Bismarck.
Yeah.
Longest Day.
Yeah.
We Joined the Navy.
What's that?
It's a film. you got to think that's four.
I don't think we'll be covering that.
Oh,
though,
What a Lovely War.
Right.
Battle of Britain.
Was he not in Battle of the River Plate?
No. No. And then that's it. So I don't think he is going to win.
Oh, he was. Talking of other sea things, he was in A Night to Remember.
Yeah.
About the Titanic
sinking. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is, by the way, listeners, a much better film than Titanic.
That's been hailed as one of his best performances.
Mm.
But it's weird, isn't it? Because
Why do we keep seeing him? I'm sure we've seen him in more things than that.
The thing is with Kenneth Moore...
Oh, he was also in Battle of Britain, as well as Reach for the Skies. Did you say that?
Yeah.
All right, I'll shut up.
That's all right.
He was also in The Spaceman and King Arthur.
Fantastic. Another must-watch. But the strange thing is about him, he's quite a wooden actor.
Mm.
You know, yet there's...
He was very wooden in Reach for the Sky.
But there's some... Oh. You can't cut that out.
So listen, guess who we didn't see that we were so excited about?
Hold on.
No. Roy Castle.
Oh, yeah. He was record breakers.
He was supposed to be Seaman on Prince Charles. Sorry.
Easy for you to say.
Seaman on Prince of Wales.
It's easy for you to say. That's disgraceful. Hold on.
Yeah, we never spotted him. We were so excited about it at the end of last episode.
Oh, of course we were, yeah.
And then...
Just because of the Julian Clary-like innuendo.
Who were misses?
I was about to say something more about Kenneth Moore, but there's something extremely beguiling about him as an actor, and I can't put my finger on it. But I really enjoy watching him. But he's not gonna, you know, he's won a couple of BAFTAs here and there. No mean feat by any stretch of the imagination.
Right.
But he turned down Hamlet for a reason, as in he knew he probably couldn't do it.
The one that Olivier ended up playing?
No, on stage.
Oh,
he was
right.
Just like, he decided it was like, you know, yeah, it's not for me, old boy.
Maybe if he'd done him with, like, wooden legs, he might have been all right.
Oh, my God.
So, I mean, is there really much more to say about it?
No, I don't think so. But we can definitely go back to what we used to do. It does have a stereotypical Nazi.
It does have a stereotypical Nazi.
That's the Admiral, of course.
Yeah, Lugens.
And does it have a Best Death Award? I think there was a couple.
Oh, there was. There was a great one, which I've seen in the trivia.
Listen how excited he is, listeners.
Death. Great death. Which apparently was true. So the Prince of Wales was, of which there was a seaman in.
Jesus
Christ. Wait. Record breakers.
Get your trumpet out, Castle.
Sorry. The Prince of Wales received a direct hit on the bridge, and only the captain survived it, amazingly. And the rest of the officers on the bridge... What's so funny? This is terrible. Jesus. The rest of the bridge were killed.
I'm sorry, it was just the Prince of Wales received from a seaman a direct hit. That's
cutting that out. So, the bridge of the Prince of Wales received a direct hit, and all the staff, all the officers on the bridge were killed, with the exception of the captain. And there's a great bit. I mean, I don't know whether it can be called a best death, but it's really chilling. Where downstairs, you don't say that, do you? Below decks, in the map room or the radio room, you know how sailors talk to each other through those tubes, speaking tubes, and they go, hard to starboard, or that sort of thing.
That bit's really
and this dumb. Guy is poring over a map, and suddenly something sort of starts dripping on it, and he looks up, and blood is dripping out of the speaking tube from the bridge onto his maps.
That's disgusting.
And apparently that was absolutely true. That did happen. Yeah, so there were so many people killed on the bridge.
That bit's amazing.
That's a good... See, there should have been more of that.
Yeah.
More threat, more sort of pain and...
It definitely... Well,
it was very clean and clinical,
it does,
given how many people died in this.
It does feel like a missed opportunity. There are parts which I think are really moving and really gripping. There's just not enough of them. And the weird thing is that it's, what, an hour and 40 minutes long? And it feels like 2.5.
Oh, well, I missed quite a bit of it as I sawed logs and was asleep. But here's another contender for best death for you, Simon.
Right.
Something that probably didn't actually happen, but is in the film, and it takes up a good, like, 10 minutes of film, is that there's a sort of Norwegian resistance guy who is... Wow, there's even a whole preamble where Michael Horden's like, well, we've got to start him up, we've got to send him in, and somebody else says, but it's a suicide mission. He goes, no, we need the information. So they send this resistance fighter, and you see him on the fjord, and he spots the ship coming out, and he runs back to his cabin, and he pulls out his wireless set and his Morse code machine.
Yeah.
You knew what that was, didn't you?
Yeah.
And as he's tapping away, the Germans burst in and machine gun him, but he keeps going. It's great because he's like collapsed underneath the desk, but his arm's still up and he's going, and then they shoot him again. That's a great death. Come on.
Very heroic.
Yeah, that's what you want.
So tell me, Dan, overall... If the fact is that you fell asleep for a little bit of it. Not for long, I don't think.
I had a little snooze.
What do you give Sink the Bismarck out of 5? Be honest.
I think I'm going to have to go with a 2.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty low.
I was really bored.
Yeah, there were parts that I found boring, but there were parts that I found really chilling and moving. So I'm going to give it a 3.
Okay.
Which I think is what I gave 49th Parallel as well.
Yeah, you did. Because I talked you round.
You did, yeah. Because I was in a bad mood, I think.
You were furious.
Well, I was furious I had to watch it twice in such a short space of time. Well, it probably is. And then...
Should we mention just briefly, super quick before we wrap this up, the constant appearance of Edward R. Murrow?
Oh, God, of course, played by himself.
Who was added, apparently, to add some gravitas to the film post-production, really.
Right.
And he's sort of a narrator, because, for those who don't know, Edward R. Murrow was the most respected war correspondent. He was an American journalist and a radio journalist, and he was sort of one of the most respected voices during the Second World War.
That was a great movie as well, with David Strathairn as Edward R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.
Oh, I never saw it.
Directed by George Clooney, I think.
With Jason Statham?
No, David Strathairn.
Oh, sorry.
Jason, that would have been amazing.
Like, Edward R. Murrow, the killer.
The Stath as R. Murrow. Good night and good luck.
Yeah, so you can only imagine that they basically watched the rushes of this and went, oh, dear, we're sort of lacking some.
Oh, I don't think so. I think they were very pleased with themselves.
Did they put Edward R. Murrow in it playing himself?
I don't know. But
it's all sort of nonsense, like, the British fleet are in hot pursuit. It's all this... why? We get it. We know that. We can work it out.
You kind of get that as well in, if you remember, Battle of the River Plate.
But with the two two spies.
At Christopher Lee's Manolo's bar with the American journalist who won't leave his table. Just keeps collecting bottles of whiskey.
So he can stay there and keep reporting.
Rum, yeah, exactly. Oh, so great.
So 2 from me, I'm afraid.
3 from me. That means
I think that's the first time I've given lower than you.
I think it is. Right. So the next one is going to be quite interesting.
Go on.
Well, we're looking.
I'm so excited.
We're looking. Finally, we're getting off the sea.
Oh, there's been far too many toffs at sea.
Yeah, this is not toffs at sea. This is Czechs on very dry land. Mm. We are looking at the Czech version of Tobruk.
Yeah, a sort of little known fact that of the many battles that were fought for Tobruk, it changed hands so many times. The first one was basically fought by Allied soldiers from Czechoslovakia.
So it's the Czech Tobruk, directed by Vlaklav Morav, and he's an amazing director. Probably not that well known out of the festival circuit in Western cinema, but he is a true artist. In fact, if you ever get a chance to see the film, I mean, I'd love to show it, but it's quite arty and Dan might burn it before it gets near the DVD. The Painted Bird is an absolutely rip-roaring film, although extremely traumatic. So yeah. I'm really looking forward to seeing this. We aim to do this as soon as possible so we can get this next one out before Christmas as well as our Christmas special.
Yes. We might have I've been thinking, Simon, might have a different format for this year's Christmas special, given how the British public have lost their appetite for war films during the festive period.
Why?
Because last time we sat there pouring through the Radio Times and finding nothing.
No, you should re-listen to it. We found loads.
I did.
We found loads.
I did re-listen to it. That's why I'm saying it. Well, this is obviously an argument me and Si have to have another time.
What do you want to do for it then?
What's the secret?
I'm not going to tell the listeners. We could go on a pub crawl around Woodstock and then end up at the Oxford's Army Museum.
So the listeners can hear us getting thrown out for being drunk and disorderly. No.
Doing a Kenneth Moore.
Yes. How dare you? Don't know who I am. Right. So listen, there you go. Sink the Bismarck. Most of us Brits know it. It's sort of seemed to be on a lot when I was a kid. And yet, for me, slightly disappointing. Certainly not as exciting as the actual event was and the film should have been. But there you go. Stay tuned for next time. And
To Brook.
In the meantime, you have been listening to...
The Foxhole Companion.